Hello and welcome to episode 722 of the official EstablishTheRun.com podcast. My name is Adam Levitan. I'm one of the co-founders here at ETR, and today we are joined by a young man who I believe holds the current record for most guest appearances. You may remember him from the online poker streets back in the day. You may know him from stock gambling. Investing streets. It is professional options trader, runs the firm Caption Partners. The one and only Jason Strasser. How's it going, buddy?
What's up, man? Thanks for having me.
I believe this is Jason's fifth time on the show. I always love having Jason on, really for selfish reasons, because I am fascinated by financial markets and I know absolutely nothing about them. But I've also gotten a ton of great feedback on these shows with Jason. If you want to know more about his background, please go back to his first appearance, episode 69, and I'll find his other episodes after that. Before we get into it here today, Jason is a very big time professional. He needs to read a very professional disclaimer from his lawyers. I give you the floor to disclaim, Jason.
All right. The information being shared in this podcast does not constitute an offer to sell or solicitation of any offer to buy or sell any securities and does provide any investment advisory services. This information is not meant as a general guide to investing or as a source of any specific investment recommendation. Any projections, outlooks, or estimates discussed during this podcast are forward-looking statements based upon specific assumptions and should not be construed as indicative of any actual events that have occurred or may occur.
Not financial advice is what he's trying to say. And some would say, DYOR, do your own research. Okay. On today's show, we're going to talk about all things stocks, crypto, markets, and I want to get to a bunch of your listener questions. People sent in a bunch of good ones. Before we get into it today, quick note, golf major coming up this week, the PGA Championship. We do have weekly and monthly options available for our PGA product, which includes projections, ownership, ton of data, and content from our golf bros. Head to EstablishTheRun.com if you're interested. All right, Jason, let's start here. Since you were last on, roughly 12 months ago, market has been smashing. I mean, I know there's been some bumps along the way, but overall, market has been absolutely smashing since you've been on. I believe Dow is up 17%. S&P 500 ticked all-time highs, up 26% in the last 12 months. QQQ, the tech-ish ETF, 37%, basically straight up since September of 2022, literally. So what's been going on? Macro perspective, why has the market been smashing so hard for the last 12 months?
Fascinating last year for sure. I think if someone had told you where interest rates ended up and what the market did, it would be kind of a shocking outcome if you like rewound the clock. I think you have to break it down into a couple parts. So let's just use rough numbers here. Everything here is rough numbers, but you know, something like the equity markets went from 35 trillion to 50 trillion in the US. I'm just broadly speaking, the value of all stocks, something like that, maybe 40 to something like that. All of that 10 to 15 trillion of gain, the AI stuff was a meaningful contributor to it. You know, Nvidia alone was something like 2 trillion. And then a lot of the other gains in other big tech and things like that were on the back of this AI hype. So you really can't, you can't look at the gains in the market last year without considering the AI. If you strip down the AI effect, we probably have a very normal looking return in the last year, up probably just a normal amount, 5, 6, 7%, not what we've seen. So I think, you know, I think we have some idea. You want to talk about this later down the line, but like then we need to dive into the AI stuff because that's really what's going on here. That's what's changed in the last year, year and a half. And, you know, I have a lot of thoughts on that. I don't know if I jump into that, but that's really the difference. If you had to sum up the last year, it's that's what's happened.
Okay, I do want to get to the AI, but I do want to hit on the inflation point you made first, because inflation, and I know we talked about this last time, I think my question on inflation now is, if inflation is so bad for the economy, and you said you're surprised that given where rates are, that the market is up so much, if inflation is so bad for the economy, if so many people are out there struggling, I mean, I go to the grocery store and I don't think that inflation's coming down, a carton of eggs is still 12 bucks or whatever, how is the market crushing in the face of inflation, or is inflation something that doesn't affect the market, only affects like consumers and when I go to the stores and stuff like that?
Yeah, this is a multifaceted question that has a kind of a complicated answer, but I'll try to give my best attempt at it. When rates go higher, there are certain stocks that have to reprice. I mean, all stocks, if you take an economics class, right, the risk-free rate is how you price every asset based off of. So as the risk-free rate goes off of, asset prices are supposed to go down, right? That's just like economics 101. every single market though has its own nuances. So like real estate, for example, if you read a textbook, you said rates go up, value of real estate needs to go down, obviously, right? Because mortgage prices goes up, affordability goes down, blah, blah, blah. But what we've seen in the market is that housing prices haven't gone down. They've actually gone up because there's a supply constraint. And I think if you just go through things like that, like the textbook answer is rates go up, it's bad for assets. But the more and more things you dive into, if you dive into like, for a while there, not as much anymore, for a while there during COVID, especially, there's used car price inflation. You know, every market has their own little thing. Cost of insurance has gone bananas because you have all this like, you know, damage due to, you know, the environment and due to other factors, and they just weren't pricing them right. So I don't know if you look at your auto insurance bill, it's up 30% year over year or something crazy like that. I don't know how to describe it. Like from a textbook perspective, you should get lower asset prices when rates go up. But in the real world, you've just seen these different things. And of course, the AI thing has led to massive, massive, massive inflation because people are trying to buy these chips and they're spending tons and tons of money. Your average person, though, like that's suffering from inflation, I just want to be honest, like most people that inflation hits the hardest where gas prices and food prices really matter, not the people buying stocks. And so, yeah, it's. I'm still, even given what's happened with the AI thing, I'm still very, very surprised at how strong the market's been the last year. I mean, I think it's just, I don't think a lot of people would have called this right at all. And, you know, whether it's like overheated or not, we can have that discussion, but certainly it's been an extremely big move in the backdrop of something that's usually not helpful for stock prices.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you think AI is the big thing here. So let's talk about it. We had the dot-com boom. We had the internet search ad boom, you know, Facebook, Google type stuff. We had what was supposed to be the blockchain boom where it's kind of fizzled in real life. We'll get to crypto in a little bit here. Now it's the AI boom. And everybody says that, you know, this is not some flimsy thing. This is not a fad. This is here to stay. The narrative is that this technology will send companies, whoever wins in this space, to the absolute stratosphere. Now we've seen it so far with NVIDIA making chips that people are using for AI. What is your take on all of this AI stuff and how it affects the market?
How I organize this in my head is in three groups. So the first thing is the data center. So that's what we've seen so far. Right now, there's a whole bunch of people that are like, I need more computing power in my data center. I need these chips from NVIDIA and AMD and other people. I need these in my data center. And there's been a massive, massive, massive amount of demand for these chips that the chips aren't even, you know, they can't make enough chips right now to satisfy this demand. So what you've seen is just historical levels of ordering, incredible pricing power. You know, I think NVIDIA is running gross margins of 80% for a hardware item that's just unheard of. And you're seeing just, you know, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, all just trying to buy as many of these chips as they can, just spending billions and billions and billions of dollars. So what's happening in the data center right now is money's going to NVIDIA and others from the big tech companies. And that to me is obviously, if you could go back in time, you buy NVIDIA. That was the obvious trade. But a lot of the effects of sort of, the data center stuff's happening first. The second level is going to be tools. So people that buy this computing power, Facebook, whoever, they're going to build tools. The only tool that's had any huge effect on the world so far is ChatGPT. Everything else is sort of secondary to that. But if you fast forward 2-3 years from now, there are going to be all sorts of tools that are going to be using this technology. So right now, there's a land grab for the data center. Next step is the tools. And again, we have one tool now, but we're going to have a lot more later. And all these companies that are spending all this money are trying to build tools. You know, Adobe's got a cool one. I don't know if you saw what you can do with Photoshop now. You can kind of type in things, it guesses. It's pretty awesome. But like, you're going to see like tons of iterations of this. The last step, which people are not talking about, but it's in people's mind right now. And if you sort of listen to people like Elon or people pontificate about the future that are like that, it's productivity. And that is potentially kind of a scary thing, but we've seen some of this in technology. So for example, I don't know if you've seen the layoffs at these big tech companies. So Facebook and, you know, Twitter and, you know, Tesla and whatever, all these big tech companies, whether you want to include Tesla or not, that's up for debate. But all of them, Google, they've all had these big layoffs. And have they been less productive? It doesn't seem that way at all. They're able to, and just from my experience at Caption, you know, our software developers, can find bugs in ChatGPT. If they're translating from one coding language to another, ChatGPT can do like 95% of it. They need a human to do 5%. So we're already seeing the productivity, I would say, in software development. If you talk to your average friend that's a software developer, they're using this technology. They're also using things like marketing. Look at the spam emails you get. They're way better than they used to get. So what's happening, though, what's going to happen later is a lot of people are going to lose their job. And productivity of these companies is going to get a lot better. And we haven't even started talking about things like fast food restaurants. You know, you go through a drive-thru now, you go to Starbucks, you give your order to a human. You know, that's not going to be human forever. And you call a call center now. Like, you're going to start talking to robots and computers. Like, that's where things are going. And there's going to be massive productivity gains and maybe some tricky situations with job losses. And so it's a very fascinating to think about what that world looks like. But what I would say is the stock market is all over the data center stuff right now. Whether it's overhyped or underhyped, they're all over it. Tool stuff is kind of like in the middle. There's going to be a whole bunch of companies you've never heard of that are probably creating tools that we use down the future, just like ChatGPT, no one had heard of. And then productivity in the stock market, no one's really talking about where all the money's going to be saved down the line, except for the tech companies that are laying people off. And so I think it's really interesting to sort of think where we are. We're in step one right now, sort of. And after we filter down, you're going to see a lot of changes in this world.
Along those lines, I know you've talked about this before. Like the S&P 500, most of the gains come from a few companies. You know, the companies that you mentioned, NVIDIA, Facebook, Tesla, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Apple. Is this like scary or is this precedented? Like, has the S&P 500 always been so concentrated to seven companies? And is this okay in the light of the AI stuff, which sounds like you're bullish on in terms of margins, productivity? Is it okay that these seven companies, like everybody's retirement fund is concentrated to these seven companies because everybody's retirement fund is the S&P 500, right?
Yeah, the way I would think about it is, you know, passive investing in the style of the S&P 500, you know, the more a stock goes up, the higher a concentration it gets. So a new dollar that goes to the S&P is more likely to go to the winners and less to the losers. So the S&P 500 has been buying more and more big tech companies over the last 15 years. If you go back in the day, I think the number one holding would have been like Exxon or like, you know, one of these kind of companies. But, you know, where we are today is the big tech companies are the biggest waste in the S&P. It wasn't always that way. And what I would point out is that what I think has happened is the S&P has gotten the best trade of the last 15 years wrecked accidentally. You know, like just they bought the big tech companies as they got bigger and bigger and bigger. As they went up, you were supposed to buy them, keep buying them, keep buying them. So they got that trade right, not because they're geniuses, just because the structure just sort of works for that. I think big tech is still a very reasonable thing to own. I just think at the size of these companies now, at the market caps, there's no new people to join Facebook. You know, there's no new people to sign up for Amazon. You know, it's like we're at this point now where like law of large numbers, as long as people understand that these are turning into more of a utility type investment, you know, these are the world's utilities and not this like mega growth thing. We just can't close our eyes and get 30% returns from here on out in these big tech companies going forward. It just can't happen. In my opinion, can't happen. So I think the S&P 500 is not the best option for a lot of people. Because it is so concentrated towards the top, it's a little bit more risky, in my opinion, than it used to be in the past. There are a lot of, you know, I encourage people to read David Einhorn's letter. So he works Greenlight Capital. It's the letter that's available online usually. His most recent letter really does a wonderful job talking through sort of the dynamics with how passive and active interacting and how there are a lot of companies that have been left behind by the passive boom. And, you know, I think for the people that are more interested in investing and getting active, there are some opportunities to look over more things that have been left behind by this, you know, by the S&P and things like that.
So I guess my question is, isn't that the way that the S&P 500 is supposed to work? In other words, you know, I don't know which AI companies are going to hit, but if I buy the S&P 500, I'm going to catch some of them that are just starting to grow and then I'll grow with them in the S&P 500 as they get bigger. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure there's some small companies right now that aren't in the S&P 500 yet, but they will be, and they are going to win in AI, in an AI at some point, right?
Right, but the way I think about it now is your bet on NVIDIA now is 10 times bigger than it was 2 years ago. So basically, when you put new money in, yes, of course, you're going to have little exposure. The next NVIDIA, you'll own a small piece of it now, and it'll be bigger later. But really what you own today is NVIDIA. Like, so what matters now is how NVIDIA does. yes, you'll get some, you know, some hits, hopefully hit some winners in the other 490 stocks, but you just can't, you can't hide the fact that I think it's 40 to 45% of the S&P is large tech companies. And so that's what you're buying. So success and failure of the future is going to be those 45%.
If people are bullish AI long-term and they want exposure to it, is the best way to like do your own research, go find some companies that are small and are focused on AI and you like them? Or is there another way that you think people should be getting exposure to AI, or if they should?
Yeah, like I said, all the AI exposure now is on like the data center stuff. You know, who's making money in the data center today? I would shift to two, which is the tools. Like, who's going to build these tools going forward? You know, there's some hype on that, but like, there's going to be some massive winners there that we don't know about yet. And then the third is productivity. Like, who's going to get to fire everyone? And I don't think the market's thinking about that at all. So if I was to think about the next 5-10 years, I would really be focusing on tools to be built that people are going to use, and who gets to fire everyone.
All right. Let's go to some of the personal finance questions that I get all the time. One of the biggest things that I don't know why people ask me, but because I have no idea, but people ask me all the time, like, should I use wealth management? Should I have an advisor on my finances? Now, for people that don't know how this works, typically you give someone some wealth management firm or some big bank has wealth management arms, whatever, and they charge anywhere from, I don't know, 50 basis points to 85 basis points a year to basically invest for you. Now, if you ask someone like Warren Buffett or like that, you're an idiot, you could just buy the S&P 500 or whatever, and you'll outperform these people because they're charging you fees to do all this other stuff. If there's people out there who say, should I be using this kind of wealth management, how would you help them think about that?
I'm biased here. I'm in active management, so just a disclaimer. But my thoughts on this have always been the same, which is that the best option for the people that really are good allocators are the best active management, right? So if you have access to the best active management, that's usually the right answer for people. Net of fees, the performance of, let's just make up something like a Citadel's, you know, multi-manager hedge fund. Those results are public. You know, those results are incredible over long periods of time. And the amount of sophistication involved in a firm like that is incredible. So I always think if you have access to very good active, that's usually the answer. Now, most people don't. So let's go, the next best option is passive. I think there are ways of doing passive smartly and less smart. And I think with a little bit of work, you can have a more diversified portfolio that's not all big tech, for example, and have, you know, I'm not a big fan of geographic diversification. I don't really think over long time frames, you need to be in Europe, you need to be in Japan. You know, that's my view. I think over like the next 30 years and the success and failure of your investments are going to come down to, you know, where does the next innovation come from? Which economy does it come from? Like, I'm very much pro-US on that. So. Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's just say, but I like I said, I think there are ways of doing passive without too much effort. And then the third thing is, yes, you could hire your like run-of-the-mill financial advisor. There are really good ones that basically can almost justify or more than justify their fees, especially if their fees are kind of in the 50 basis points, 70 basis points range. It's theoretically possible that they're gonna claw back some of those fees. And so maybe instead of costing you 50, 60, it caught you 10, 20. You're also looking at sort of like the cost of a psychiatrist in a way, because what those people are good at is when the market goes down, they'll talk you into making good decisions. They'll help you overall with your sort of, they'll also like do things like family planning and like help you with, you know, your estate and things of that nature. So I think you have to think about those people in that lens as well. You're the same way you pay a shrink, you might pay these people to manage your money so that you have someone like can hold your hand in 2020 or 2008 or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I know nothing. I just kind of don't want to think about this. I find it fascinating, right? But like, if we're talking about real money, I don't trust myself to not like panic sell. You know what I mean? I think that's what Jason's referring to.
That's the right thing to do. Like, honestly, like most people like yourself are better off focusing on making money and knowing what they do well. You know, if you're taking tons of time away from making money in your careers or your businesses, and you're focusing on managing your own money, it's just a distraction. So, I think there's a lot that has to go into it, but I don't have any problem with someone using a financial advisor to do some basic stuff. A
couple questions from the audience on this. Justin says, for a typical 9-to-5 bro, what is the best way to invest in a 401k? So I assume this is most people listening, investment is probably in a 401k vehicle somehow. Any advice for people that are in this spot with the 401k retirement investments?
401k is the company can pick the menu of things you can invest in. So it's hard to give blanket advice on like what to do in a 401k. Typically what I do, what I've done in the past is just find like a reasonable passive low fee product and just all in that, basically equities. That's what I've done. I think the thing you think about the 401k is you probably want to take over a long-term time frame. You know, the real benefit is sort of the tax advantages of how it can compound. So you want to put your sort of more higher risk stuff, not super crazy stuff, but like you probably just want a bunch of stocks in your 401k if you're, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s or whatever. So that's kind of how I approach it. You have to look really closely at all the funds. So I think it's important. Just go through the funds, look at the expense ratios, look at what they're doing. You probably don't want whatever active option they have. You probably want the low fee kind of broad based thing. Don't overthink it. That's what I would say. And just max it out. Like that's the other thing. Just max it. I see people that don't max it out, even beyond the match, if you're able to. Like you should obviously put in whatever your employees will match. You should also put in more than that. If you're financially able to, you should max the thing out. It is an incredible tool. So I think that's the big thing. Just put the money in that you're already winning, and then just, you know, don't buy something really insane. They do sneak some crazy things in there sometimes.
Bowtie Turtles had a question about bonds. And actually, this crossed my mind also. He says, thoughts on stock, bond, crypto allocation with where bond yields are today. So my impression was that if equities are getting crushed, bonds are going to do well, and maybe vice versa. I don't know. Maybe that's like a donkey way to think about it and not true. But it seems like bonds have been getting crushed, not performing. They were like getting crushed at the same time stocks were getting crushed. And then stocks went to the moon, and bonds still haven't really been doing much from what I can tell. What are your thoughts on bonds? It seems like this is like the hitting singles or low risk stuff. People diversify, you put you in bonds, and then it's like, well, see, we didn't lose you any money, but we also didn't really win very much either. So yeah, any thoughts on that question?
Yeah, if you rewound 2 years ago, like safe bonds, you made 1 or 2%. And a lot of people were investing those bonds through financial advisors who were taking 40, 50, 61% of it, 1%. So like half the return, up to half the return of it. It was just completely insanity to have like a reasonable allocation to bonds when they gave you nothing. So when we talked during COVID, like we never talked about putting money in bonds. Like it was like, it just didn't make any sense. You're better off just earning zero and having no downside risk, or put it in a money market and get tiny bits. Today it's different. You're right. Bonds have been a really poor asset class the last couple of years. That being said, I mean, they're better to invest in now than they were previously. I don't think people should go crazy. You know, the 30-year U.S. is 4.5%. The 10-year is also around 4.5%. You can get, 5.25% right now in a money market, whatever, soon to be going down probably later this year. But I think most people, honestly, it's not a great market to plow everything in. You know, I think the thing you want to think about with your investment strategy is you want to be able to take more risk when it's better to invest, and you want to be able to take less risk when it's not a great time to invest. But you also just don't want to sit all in cash or things like that, because like crazy things can happen. It's just not that practical to time like super insane. So the way I like to think about it is you have a portfolio, you have the ability to take more risk or less risk. I think right now you should be on the less risk side of things. So like a lot of my friends or whatever, you know, myself too, like keeping 5, 10, 15, 20%, whatever in sort of this just money market stuff. It's not bad. You get 5%, you preserve flexibility, or you can buy some shorter dated government bonds, get 4.5%. I personally am, I think that's much more reasonable of a thing. So stock, bond, crypto. Crypto is always hard to talk to people about, like what percent to put in crypto. You know, I think most people should have 5 to 10%, but most of your listeners probably have 50% or more. You know, we can talk about crypto later, but for as far as stock and bonds, you know, before it would have been very, very heavily weighted to equities. I still think that's the right move, but there's definitely some benefit to just earning 5% and seeing, hey, maybe the market's a little bit better. Maybe there's some better opportunities down the line. I really like that way of thinking.
Yeah. I mean, keep some dry powder on the sidelines for sure. I mean, you saw if you had dry powder on the sidelines when things bottomed out during COVID, you got some insane.
Exactly. And like, you can't sit around waiting for COVID to happen, but, you know, just look at valuations of the stocks right now. It just, if you look at, you know, asset prices versus historical levels, they're just not like, it's not an incredible time to be an investor. It's somewhere in the range of okay to not great. That's what I would classify it as.
All right. I don't think we've talked in an election year, or maybe we have, but I don't know that we focused on it. I don't really want to talk about politics or the election, obviously, but I am interested in how all this stuff affects markets. I guess first, all this stuff with the geopolitical landscape, war in the Middle East, war in Ukraine, there was like shipping channel regions were getting overrun by rebels or whatever, and X goods are delayed. Obviously, that affects the economy, but how much are you tracking what's going on in the Middle East, in Ukraine, and geopolitics as a whole when it comes to projecting market, what's going to happen in markets?
I mean, you have to pay attention to what's happening in the Middle East. If you're in any market, in anything, crypto, whatever you're looking at, you have to pay attention to it. Obviously, it's one of those types of things where it's, I don't want to handicap it exactly, but like 90% not to be something terrible and 10% to be something terrible. And obviously, the conflict could escalate, and then who knows, all bets are off as for what could happen. Especially, you know, there's some speculation, maybe China's looking at Taiwan. If that happened, I mean, if you ask someone, hey, what happens if China invades Taiwan, they basically will tell you, it's so bad that I'm just like, everyone's screwed in that scenario. I'm not even gonna worry about it. Like, I've heard that answer before. So there are some like geopolitical risks. I mean, I would say, you know, war breaking out in the Middle East for real, war Taiwan are both on the radar. You have to pay attention to them because they're serious. But again, they're kind of long shots. As far as the election, big picture, you know, this is the idea that like Democrats are good with bad with money and Republicans are good with money. Throw that all out the window, right? Like Republicans have been shit with money and Democrats have been shit with money. You know, Democrats spend too much. I think the last balanced budget was Clinton. The Reagan Republicans don't even exist anymore. You know, Paul Ryan had his moment, but that was totally dead. Like both these parties are terrible with spending. So as far as, and just budget balancing. So I think for the markets, you know, we were talking about a lot more things in 2016, for example, healthcare. We're like, oh my gosh, if Bernie Sanders wins, wow, what's going to happen there, 2020? Or, you know, Trump had some ideas about getting rid of Obamacare. And like, there were some key issues that really could impact markets. I really don't see a whole lot. You know, we could talk about like solar policy as an area. Okay, yes, I do agree there are differences in the candidates between on solar. Israel is interesting to think. You know, there are some rhetoric coming out, but, you know, honestly, at the end of the day, I don't think as an investor, you need to really sweat this election too hard. I think if Trump wins, we're going to see a little bit of a rally. If Biden wins, maybe we'll see a little bit of a sell-off. I don't think we're seeing dramatic sell. I don't think there's a huge bullet for Trump to fire like he did with last time with the tax cuts. So that's my view. I don't think we're going to see anything too crazy. I think the candidates for the market are pretty similar.
One of my friends is like some PE bro, and all he roots for every election is gridlock, right? He wants the House and the Senate, one to be Republican and one to be Democrat. And he just doesn't want all three, President, Senate, House, to all be the same. He just wants things to like stay normal, stay out of the way. Nothing gets passed. Nothing gets done in Washington. He's just allowed to go do his business without, you know, one side being able to push through their agenda. That struck me as makes sense, like, you know, that's good for markets. Any thoughts on just rooting for gridlock if we're rooting for markets?
Yeah, like I said, I mean, I think people are expecting not much to happen on the next election. Now, I think what you need to keep an eye on, if you're worried about, like, obviously we're going to talk about like government spending and the deficit and the, you know, the crazy amount of debt we have in this country, but, you know, big picture, keep an eye on the 30-year. The long-dated government bonds. Like right now, they're 4.5%. If people were seriously concerned with like major spending or things like that, you would see it show up there. If that goes to 5, 6, 7, 8%, then we're a different ballgame. So I think like the market's usually pretty good about this stuff. If you see a lot of panic on the long-dated U.S. government bonds, that's when you know something is wrong. But gridlock, yeah. I mean, like I said, I really don't see huge policy differences between them. I just don't.
Okay. National debt is an issue that I think people don't know whether to care about or not. I mean, I think that's a really big question because people are like, oh, well, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, says that our interest payments alone are going to be $870 billion in fiscal year 2024. then rise rapidly. And we're talking about $1.6 trillion with a T in just interest payments in 2034. In total, interest payments will total $12 trillion over the next decade. Now, that sounds like a huge problem to me, but other people are like, eh, it doesn't matter. You know, we've had debt forever. We have less debt than other country. We have good credit. I don't even know what the answer is. Should we actually care about this or not, that our country is in such debt that we're paying trillions in interest alone each year?
There's the sort of my belief, and then there's the market's angle. Like, I believe we should absolutely care about this. You know, we're spending now for our children to deal with later. You know, we're probably not looking at any imminent problem. You know, as you pointed out, like, Japan has like twice as much debt to GDP or whatever. And so there's plenty of, you know, if you thought about it like a company, you know, the US GDP, what, 20 trillion or something, and we have 35 trillion in debt. If you were looking at a company, it wouldn't be like insane to have this like leverage ratio. So, you know, there's an argument to be made, like, yes, our debt will grow in the future, but GDP will grow in the future. If they kind of like stay together, it's reasonable. I just don't think we're at a level currently. Now, what you pointed out, right now, we have I think we take in $4.5 trillion in revenue as a government, and we spend sort of $6 to $6.5 trillion. So there's $1.5 billion to $2 billion. As you pointed out, all our debt right now is basically two-ish percent or 3%. Well, let's do the math. Let's call it 2.5-3% is our current yield, but it's going to go up because, you know, bonds today are more expensive for them to sell. So, yes, it's really kind of scary. You add another $600 trillion just in interest alone, then we go from a $2 trillion to $3 trillion gap. You know, we spent a lot of money during COVID. And I always like to point out, like, that to me made sense. Like, COVID was bad. Like, we have a government so that when COVID happens, they can step in there and you know, keep things to hold things together, which is what they did. So, you know, $4 or $5 trillion of our deficit came, you know, during that time. And it's hard to look back on that. Yes, there was an incredible amount of fraud with some of that stuff, but big picture, like, that's what governments are there for. Now, in good times, which I would say right now the economy is relatively good times, should we really be racking up $2 trillion deficit? It's probably irresponsible. But, you know, if they got it down to $1 trillion, which they're not going to, but if they did, you know, there are some things where you can grow into it, or I don't think we're looking at an imminent issue. And like I said, keep an eye on the 30-year. If you start to see panic on, like, will the U.S. be able to have to print so much money or, like, have credit issues, you're going to see it there.
So to me, like, this issue is not going to be solved by less spending, right? What politician is going to run and say, I'm going to do nothing and you guys are going to vote for me, or I'm going to cut your benefit? And so to me, the way that this is going to be eventually solved is by raising taxes on rich people. And they're talking about, like, people like you, you know what I mean? They're like, these people who are managing money at really high levels should be getting taxed at 60, 70%. And that's how we're going to end up balancing the budget. And there's, like, that's really popular, right? If you went out and polled, should we be taxing people 50, 60, 70% at the highest ends of the income bracket? That's how eventually this ends up being solved. I just don't know if that's a good idea or not, but, like, how could we ever even solve this, right, without raising taxes a ton?
Like I said, I think the idea is to keep spending in check and kind of grow into it, if that makes any sense. Like, the economy is going to grow over time. If we just kind of, like, keep the deficit in this $1.5 trillion range and we just grow, it becomes less of an issue. I agree with you. There used to be politicians, by the way, that did run on spending cuts. And if things got bad, by the way, it would change. Like, if we saw genuine panic in markets about the U.S.'s ability to, like, make good on its debt and a runaway train started happening in the bond market, I do think you would see a lot of people concerned and a lot more people voting for people doing responsible things with money. So if we ever had a scenario where things ran away, I do think the voter mentality might be a little bit different. Yeah. You know, we did vote in the past 50 years. We have voted for people that ran on platforms that today looks ridiculous, like they would never win, but on spending cuts and things like that.
Yeah, Tony Dunn said, what does he think about our escalating national debt? And how does he think our next president will address the problem? Yeah, we already got to that one, but thanks for the question, Tony. This idea that our government spends money it doesn't have, is that contributing to inflation? Like, if the government keeps spending money that we don't have, is that part of the inflation problem? Because you see everybody on Twitter, they do the money go burr gif and stuff like that, where the government just prints money to spend it. Is that an inflation concern?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, government spending is a huge part of it. Just think about, you know, all the money they spend on the military, all the money they spend on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all that money is going into the economy. So government spending is absolutely a function of pricing. The more they spend, you know, look at some of the solar stuff, the more they infrastructure, the more they put money into things, there's just no other way to look at it. COVID was an extreme example. Remember like they handing money to people, you saw what happened, right? So you saw what happened to cars, you saw what happened to everything. So yeah, big picture, I think there's just no other way to look at it.
Okay. Let's get to everybody's favorite topic, crypto. So Bitcoin, all of crypto hit rock bottom with, you know, the Luna collapse, the FTX debacle. I mean, just markets bottoming out in general, but come storming back from the depths over the last 12 to 18 months. Last 12 months, Bitcoin's up 120%. The narrative out there is that a lot of this is fueled by the Bitcoin ETF. Maybe you can explain to people what an ETF actually is, how this Bitcoin one works, and why you think Bitcoin and crypto has rallied so hard over the last 12 to 18 months.
Sure. An exchange traded fund just means that when people buy it, the mechanics of it go like this. Adam goes and buys the ETF. Someone like Jane Street shorts it to Adam. Okay. So Jane Street has a short position in the ETF. And what they do is they're going to buy whatever the underlying of the ETF is. So if they sell Adam an ETF on Bitcoin, they're going to buy some Bitcoin. The Bitcoin ETF is a little bit weird. So let's use a stock example. You buy a stock ETF, Bitcoin, Jane Street will sell it to you, and they'll buy the basket of stocks that's in the ETF. Okay. When they have a big enough short position, they're going to take the stocks that they bought and they're going to give them to the ETF company and say, hey, listen, I want to create an ETF. I want to give you the stocks and I want you to give me the ETF. And then Jane Street will collapse its position. So they went from having a basket of stocks, short ETF, they will collapse the position. And they make, you know, a little bit of a spread on that transaction because they're going to charge you like a penny more for the ETF than their basket or whatever. So that's how it works. Bitcoin is the same thing. The mechanics are a little bit weird, but just think about it this way. When you put money in the Bitcoin ETF, they have to buy, someone's buying Bitcoin and it's you know, physically there. So I think the Bitcoin ETF, I got a lot of shit on Twitter because when the Bitcoin ETF launched, my thought was that we have Bitcoin futures, okay, we had them, excuse me. We had a Bitcoin futures-based ETF, EITO, and we have a lot of easy ways to buy crypto. You know, you can go on Robinhood, you can go on Square, you can go on whatever. It's a Coinbase. It's like trivial to buy Bitcoin. Like, to me, the ETF didn't unlock, now it did unlock like the use of it in a retirement fund. Maybe there are people that said the futures-based ETF wasn't great. I didn't like it. I want this one. You know, we saw all the demand for GBTC. So we knew that there was demand for products like this in that setting. I think a lot of GBTC was like people that wanted Bitcoin in a retirement kind of vehicle or whatever in their brokerage account where their margin stuff could be in one place. If you're running a margin account, you have your Bitcoin over there and you have your stocks over here, it's kind of frustrating, right? So I sort of understood those dynamics, but I didn't feel like the Bitcoin ETF was going to be this game changer where suddenly, you know, every retirement person was going to have 2-4% of their retirement fund in Bitcoin. I feel quite strongly about that still. It's hard to know exactly what's happened. So the Bitcoin ETF launched and had kind of a slow launch because money was pouring out of GBTC, which it still is. GBTC charges 1.5%. Right now, all the Bitcoin ETFs are effectively free, zero management fee. They're going to have a small one later, but it made sense the money's coming out of GBTC into the other ones. But what we've seen is pretty interesting. So at first it was kind of tepid. And then when Bitcoin ran up, you know, from like 45K to 70K or whatever, people were pouring into the ETF. So I think about $12 billion went into the ETF. And a lot of people were giving me a hard time on Twitter. They're like, yo, you never said it was, you know, 12 billion. By the way, 12 billion is a lot. And the trading dynamics of Bitcoin are such that, like, so Bitcoin market cap is like 1.2 trillion or whatever, but so much of that is not really tradable. Either it's like lost or it's like, if you look at like liquid Bitcoin markets, you know, it's not like gold. Like gold, if you bought like a billion worth of gold, it would be a very manageable transaction. And Bitcoin, it would really move it. So 12 billion of Bitcoin, a huge effect on price. So people were right about that. But what I don't think they were right about is who was buying this. And what we've seen in the last, I think, 7 or 8 weeks, zero flows into the ETF. So we saw 12 billion go in, and then now we're flatlining. And the question really is like, what actually happened there? Who was buying this $12 billion? Was it boomers in their retirement account? Was it people that normally buy crypto that are just plowing into the all-time highs in crypto? Or was there some financial stuff going on? I don't know if you look at MSTR, it's you know, owns a bunch of Bitcoin. That's all it is. Brian Saylor's like little cult thing. and a big cult thing at this point. A lot of people were, you know, and Hindenburg, I think, are one of those guys published or a trade they were doing. They're buying Bitcoin and they're shorting, you know, MSTR. So maybe there's some demand coming from people putting on this trade, right? So the whole idea, and there were some other basis trades out there that people were doing. So the whole idea is like breaking down this 12 billion, like where is it coming from? You know, I have no idea. My instinct though is that it's not like 5 billion coming from boomers. My instinct is that it's a much, much, much smaller number. And the fact that we've seen 7 or 8 weeks of nothing happening, you know, if you look at like S&P 500 flows every day, just like money goes in. It's like, that's the boomer money. Just every day, every day, every day, every day, every day. This to me felt like there were a lot of people that were repositioning things. Oh, I can put Bitcoin in my 401k in a more effective way or whatever. Sorry, IRA in a more effective way. But yeah, I think the jury is really out. There are a lot of people that think we're going to 50 billion in that ETF. And if we're sitting there and we look next year and there's 50 billion in a Bitcoin ETF, I'm completely wrong about my thesis. But what I think happened was there's some financial trades going on. There are some people that normally buy Bitcoin, just buying Bitcoin. The halving brought a bunch of people out buying Bitcoin or whatever. But the dust will settle and we'll see what happens. I'm very curious to see how it all plays out. But to me, the Bitcoin ETF is not like a major, major, major game changer.
Yeah. Crypto has gotten somewhat political lately. I've seen a bunch of people tweeting, a bunch of crypto bros have been tweeting that, you know, Trump said he was open to crypto and the Biden administration is not. I don't know how true that is or how partisan or biased it is. And then also, given the price, you know, Bitcoin is like survived now for so long and is thriving now. Has your thesis changed on Bitcoin ever replacing gold as like a store of value type thing?
So I think last I checked, Bitcoin 1.2 trillion. I think the gold, ignoring like jewelry and stuff like that, like gold is a financial asset. Let's just consider that. I think it's something like 6 trillion. So Bitcoin right now is 20% of gold. To me, that's a really fantastic outcome for Bitcoin. Gold has been around. You said Bitcoin's been around a long time, and gold has been around a long time, right? You know, there are all sorts of things that can happen to Bitcoin. I see some people talking about Bitcoin, like, you know, after the next 10 halvings, right, is the price needs to be like a few million dollars. Otherwise, it's not, you know, it's not going to work. Like, miners aren't going to be incentivized to secure the network, whatever. So there's a whole bunch, like, I think what happened when Bitcoin is great, I'm a little bit, you're not going to get, in my opinion, like, if you bought a Bitcoin, say $55,000, whatever it is, $60,000, you're not going to get, it's so hard to get a 10X from here. You don't have to. Then you're talking about it surpassing gold if you're talking like that. And you have to consider the value of gold when you think about what Bitcoin's worth at this age. And for it to succeed, I would take the other side of that. I just think gold's been doing what Bitcoin does now for a longer period of time. Obviously, Bitcoin has some advantages to gold in some ways, but so does gold has some advantages to Bitcoin. So.
When we're talking about the ETF, I forgot to ask about the Ethereum ETF. I think that's been universally shot down at this point. I haven't actually been following it. I don't know if it's still alive or if it's dead or if it's coming or what. But yeah, any thoughts on the Ethereum ETF and if that's priced in, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I don't have a strong view on this. I would guess that the regulators are sort of going to be a lot harder on Ethereum in the US than they are in Bitcoin. You know, Bitcoin is, you know, being defined more as a commodity. And, you know, because of ETH and the more flexibility you have around smart contracts and things like that, and just the way it's used and the way it's like the use case of it, I have more ETH exposure than Bitcoin exposure, but I think personally that regulators are going to have a harder time with this. So I would hope that your ETH thesis wasn't a Bitcoin, ETH ETF.
Yeah. Sar says, being an options guy, does Jason have a view on the volatility going forward implied to realize of Bitcoin now that it's been Wall Streeted? So I understand what he's saying. I think is that now that it is part of that, you can wear a suit, you can have a tie, you can carry a briefcase onto Wall Street, and you can buy Bitcoin, and this is like very much in the financial system now. How has that changed volatility or anything else? And like, because a big thing, like my stiff friends are like, yeah, Bitcoin's great and all, but I can't use it as a currency because one day I could wake up and it's 40K and the next day I wake up and it's 70K. That's not a currency, right? It can't be that volatile. But I think that's Star's question. But yeah, what do you think?
I don't have a strong view on this, but what I would say is that Bitcoin just has this weird trading dynamic where the tradable float of Bitcoin is very, very small. It's kind of like a stock where, you know, 80 to 90% of it's locked up and not traded. So the trading dynamics around Bitcoin are kind of like that. So in my opinion, until, you know, you're really never going to see it, right? There's a fixing point of 21, whatever Bitcoin. There's just so much Bitcoin that'll never be involved in the sort of financial world. So I always think there'll be a lot of volatility in Bitcoin just based on the trading dynamics. You just don't need as much money to move it around. And I think that's where I don't think the ETF really changes that too much. There'll be more buying, you know, it's easier for certain people to buy and sell, but it's the same problem when you need to move large amounts of Bitcoin. When people want to sell 5 billion of Bitcoin, it's going to have a huge impact or buy 5 billion. So I don't really see the ETF changing that a whole lot. So certainly the tail moves, I would think, are still in play for Bitcoin. Both up and down.
Sar wants to make a bet with you. I think he's looking for action. He said, what would be the shortest time frame that he would, on paper, bet the S&P 500 outperforming Bitcoin? 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, longer, or not over any time frame? Sounds like he's looking for action on S&P 500 versus Bitcoin. I'm not sure, but I think that's what he's saying.
He can find that action on Twitter, but he doesn't need to get it from me. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to the listener questions. Got a bunch of good ones. Mike Sowers says, what percent of his investments are in crypto versus traditional investments? Also, why are memes a thing? And what's his idea on their growth and returns? Oh, please tell me the meme thing is over. I can't take it anymore, Jason. But yeah, what do you think about crypto versus traditional investments? And then what the hell happened with these memes going completely nuts?
Yeah, so crypto versus traditional, I think people just need to put Bitcoin in its own group, maybe Ethereum with it in its own group. Once you get outside of that, just pull up the top 50 crypto. I mean, start from 40, you know, ignore the stable coins. So like, start from like the 10th and go to the 50th. It is a steaming pile of crap. Like the idea that these valuations make any sense is just asinine. Like maybe you could find one coin in 10 to 50 that has some sense to it. The meme stuff, so crypto, like I said, I think your allocation, if you're in the sort of digital gold, you know, or you're in Ethereum maybe, fine. Like, I think you can have a responsible amount in that. I don't think you should go crazy. Like, there are people on, you know, Twitter that are 150% long this stuff. Like, that's just not a way to live, especially if you've made it in life. You know, it's just insane. The meme stuff, yeah, I don't know what to say about that. The only thing I point out about the meme stuff is that what's interesting is that I think what people are looking for is that the memes are a game, right? It's a game. Someone makes it, they try to get it going. It's a sort of classic pump and dump vibes to it. And when you play a game, the fairest way to start a game is with a game that just got created. So if you and I were going to play this game, why would we pick some shit coin from 5 years ago that people once upon a time pumped and dumped? Let's start a new game where it's more of a fair thing. And then we'll all plow in there and we'll see who wins. And of course, net, people are going to probably small lose. There are people that are good at it. They're going to make a lot, but most people are going to lose. So that's how I kind of think about the meme stuff. It's just a video game. And everyone's like, oh, why aren't people buying my art blocks from 2020 or whatever? Well, you're out, you know, a bunch of people are bag holding that shit. Like, well, they're not going to play your game where you get to finally get out of your bags from back in the day. By the way, I have plenty of art blocks bags, but if you want any, give me. But yeah, no one's pumping that stuff because it's whatever. No, like Dogecoin is an old one, but most of the meme stuff is like brand new crap or Dog Whip Hat or whatever. Like, I've been tweeting about that. People give me a hard time. But yeah, it's a $2 billion valuation, Dog Whip Hat. But like, it's just a new game people are playing. And what I think what's going to happen is at some point they're going to go down, but there's going to be new games people play. And I do think people like playing this. Until they go broke, they're going to keep playing.
I, for one, am shocked that cartoons of animals aren't worth six figures anymore. You know, who could have possibly seen this coming? Okay. Dave says, could LLMs, artificial intelligence, break DFS in the near future? So, you know, people in this listening to this podcast.
Yeah, that's like a you question, right? I think the LLMs will be good at reading news. So like, you tell me, but like DFS to me, part of it is like getting a lot of information from lots of places and putting it together. And then building a lineup. Isn't building lineups like, you know, there are a lot of great tools, as you know, available for putting lineups together, right? So I could see a connection if it is interesting, because I do think that LLMs will be really good at compiling a lot of like news together, which I think is a big part of DFS, right?
Sure. I mean, yeah. Like the big thing in DFS lately is the sim stuff, you know, and like we've been working really hard on the sim stuff. I think that adding AI into sims or making it faster for us to compile all this data and all the news, I think was interesting. But yeah, I don't know if they'll get to like an end product using artificial intelligence to quote unquote break DFS. The human element is still always going to be there.
Yeah, certainly.
Kelsey says, how would Jason recommend someone transitioning from full-time DFS or poker to full-time equity/options trader? Any resources Jason would recommend to someone looking to make that jump? So for those of you guys who don't know, Jason made that jump full-time, one of the best poker players in the world at the time he quit playing online and went to be a stiff for the rest of his life wearing a suit. Well, not wearing a suit, wearing a Caption Partners hoodie or whatever he has on here today. But yes, any advice for people who want to get out of gambling and get into, I consider this stuff gambling also. I don't know if that's insulting to you or not. I consider all this stock stuff gambling also, just at way higher stakes. But yeah, how would you give advice to people looking to transition?
I also consider gambling now, like, I think the way you and I describe gambling is different than some people perceive gambling to be. Yeah. Like, really, you know, we know the difference between DFS and playing roulette, right? And I think some of the average people don't really conflate that, which is why no one in my world likes to use the word gambling, because they think that we're playing roulette. The way you mean gambling, I mean gambling too.
Yeah.
I think the thing people have to realize with transitioning to this side of things is that in your world, you're used to poker and DFS, you're used to going on a training website where you can pay, I want to say, $50 to $200 a month and get literally the best fucking content possible. And maybe not the best, but like really, really, really good content. I know poker much better than DFS, but like Run It Once, right? You can go and Run It Once and watch some videos of top players playing or people breaking down sims. And so I think people come to it with that mentality, like, oh, I can find this on YouTube or I can pay a class. It doesn't really exist. A lot of trading has to do with taking the other side of other people's trades and learning how that all works. Honestly, like, you have to start working somewhere and learn. Like, that's the thing people don't want to hear. Most of the people that are trading on their own are losing. Most of the people that are good at trading have gotten trained at a place where they at a bigger place. That's just the fact. So I think people need to get out of the mentality, unfortunately, go take a job that's a little bit humbling, go convince someone to hire you to work somewhere and learn. Like, that's your best way in. There's no course or no book. There are books that teach you the basics about options. So the best one I like is called Options Pricing and Volatility by Sheldon Nadenberg. But that's like a textbook on options. By the way, it's like super old. I don't know how old it is. At least 20 years old. So there are books out there. And the best thing I like to read are the story books. So, like, you know, More Money Than God. And I posted, there's a list of books on my pinned on my thing. And I need to update that, to be honest. But there's a lot of, you know, Moneyball for baseball. Like, yeah. I like story books. Like, I think there's a lot you can learn from learning about that. When Genius Fail, there's a ton of, you know, A Liar's Poker.
Liar's Poker, yeah.
A lot of great books like that. If you're going to spend time getting interested in markets, honestly, what I would do is first start by reading some of these old school books. And if you really love this stuff, try to figure out a way to, like, find someone who knows they're going to train you, because there's no material online that's going to help you, in my opinion.
I mean, a lot of people that I know just have these massive gaps in their resume, and you did too, right? I mean, you know, but people have even bigger gaps now. What have you been doing for the last 10 years? Oh, I've been playing poker. It's hard to get, unless you're like Susquehanna, it's hard to get someone to hire you. My thought is that people should be going to business school. I know that's very expensive. What do you think about people who want to get into it? Should they be going to business school?
Yeah. So I went straight from college to working. All my poker was while I was at college. So I never had like a gap. So I was fortunate in that sense. But like Vanessa Selps is a, you know, super well-known poker player. She had a massive gap on her resume, works at Jane Street now. She's trading, doing really well there. So there are people that have massive gaps that can make it work. It's all about networking. You know, poker was a great, great things for networking, and people recognize talent in poker, and there are people out there that will respect that. Business school is interesting. What I always tell people about business school, and I don't mean this in a snotty way, you go to business school to get a job after business school. And it's, if you go to a top five business school or you go to a top 100 business school, you're going to learn, in my opinion, similar material. The teachers might be a little bit better at the top five. They're not they're not, the content of what you're learning is roughly similar. It's just like undergrad too. Like, you know, just take two schools that are regarded way differently. You'll have a lot of like similar content at these schools. You go to business school to get a job after business school. There's a huge advantage to being in a top 20 business school. And if you're going to take out a bunch of, you know, pay for a bunch of business school, take time off from making money, there's a huge advantage to being at a good business school. So what I tell people is, if you can get into a really good business school, it's probably a viable option. If you're going to a mediocre business school, it's probably not a great option. And that's, again, I'm generalizing, but that's kind of how I feel about business school.
Okay. Eric says, what is the best way to invest for college for children, both maximal output and a way with some liquidity in case you need to take money from it before children go to college or don't need money for college? So obviously the chalk answer here is these 529 plans. I have 529 plans for my kids. They grow tax-free. The catch though is it has to be used for education. That counts for books. I believe it can count for like a little bit of spending money while they're at college, but mostly tuition is all you can spend it on. But it does grow tax-free. The problem with this is if you take it out before they go to college or they don't end up not going to college or something, there's big penalties. So any advice for people who are trying to hold money for college?
The 529 is a chalk answer. And what I would say is if your kids go to private school when they're growing up or they have costs, you can use it. It's not just college. So like if your kid's in public school, then it's different, right? You can't. So if your kid's in private school and you're worried about liquidity, you could always pull money out to pay for, you know, third grade or whatever out of there. So that's one thing to think about. Also, you can transfer them. So like if one kid has a lot more than the other kid and you can kind of move them around or what, you can change the beneficiary on these. So I think the 529, even though it's a chalky answer, is the play. Obviously, you know, the next thing you should be doing if you want more flexibility and don't want to worry about it, it just, you know, set up a brokerage account and, you know, buy some like balanced portfolio or hire a financial advisor and just leave it on the side. Like you don't need to overthink this. But the 529 is a no-brainer. I recommend people do estate planning. Like I'm actually in the process of just finishing that up, but like, do you have a will? If you get into a car accident, who's making medical decisions for you? If you and your partner die, who's the guardian of your children? You know, do you have life insurance? Like if you care about your family, there are things you can do for like $2,000. You do all the estate planning. You and your partner, no matter how well you're doing, should have all that stuff mapped out. The other thing too is if you pass away, you don't want your assets going into probate. You don't want to have a long process where people go in front of a judge, who are the creditors, da da da. If you set up trust, you can avoid probate. And so there's a lot of things. If you care about your children, you care about, you know, what happens after you die, like for $2,000 or less, you can set all this shit up. And if you don't have that, like, it's kind of silly to ask about a 529 if you don't have your life insurance and your plan set up.
Yeah. I mean, these programs, I totally agree with what Jason said about the estate planning. I've been trying to get through all that too. It's hard to think about, but yeah, it's important. A lot of this stuff though, when the government gives you something that can grow tax-free, I don't think people realize like how big of an advantage that is. So like not taking advantage of a 401k or not taking advantage of a 529 strikes me as a huge mistake, right? Even if you don't love it, it's not liquid. Like these vehicles that are grow tax-free seem like an absolute smash, right? How could you pass on that?
Yeah. And honestly, like, so I have a HSA at my current job or whatever, my firm. And what I realized about the HSA that I was doing wrong is the HSA is like the most incredible one. You put in pre-tax money, and there are ways near the end you can use the money or like leave it to your children or whatever. And the GTO play with the HSA is you max it out and you don't use it for healthcare expenses. It's so good at compounding and whatever that using it for healthcare expenses is insane. So there are things like that people haven't thought about. Like you're supposed to, like I max out my HSA and I every time I have a thing, I have the stupid debit card, but I never use it. I just pay for a credit card if I have an expense or whatever. Mm-hmm. So things like that, it makes a huge difference over a lifetime. It's incredible. So yes, it's incredible. Take advantage of all those programs you have available to you.
Last Steve says, if the stock market has a bias to go up over time, representing the growth of the economy, then should everyone lazily invest long-term in TQQQ to get triple returns on a diversified group of growth companies? So we talked about this at the beginning already with Jason's thoughts. I don't even know what TQQQ is. I guess it's some leveraged QQQ ETF. But yeah, if the assumption, this was always in my head too, like the assumption is just the government is never going to let stock market completely fail. It's tied too closely to everybody's retirement. Can't fail. Why aren't we just piling every cent we have into these things, into these like American companies that are going to grow like QQQ?
The answer to the question is do not do what this guy is suggesting, because TQQQ, here's the thing about levered ETFs. Okay. When stocks go up, the levered ETF has to buy more stocks, okay, to maintain the same leverage as they had before. When the stocks go down, they have to sell their portfolio. So they are extremely path dependent. So yes, you're right. Stocks have obviously go up over time. The leverage ETFs, though, are path dependent, okay? So if the path goes 2020, you're wiped out. 2020 happens, you're gone. So forget your 30-year plan. You just lost all your fucking money. You're done. So you have to acknowledge the fact that, yes, you can invest in markets for the long term, but don't set yourself up to, like, just zero out. Do not do what this guy is saying.
Okay. It wouldn't be a Jason Strasser appearance if we didn't ask him about DKNG, DraftKings, of course. Mike says, what would it take for DKNG, DraftKings, to get added to the S&P 500? How close or how far are they from the requirements?
So first of all, what I said about DraftKings in the past was that they were at the time they were losing money and they were complaining about short sellers in the market. I think that was one of the ones I was on. And what I think about that is that you shouldn't complain about short sellers. You should focus on your business. If your business does well and you tell everyone, hey, we're going to make money one day, and you execute, it won't matter what the shorts are doing. And I think DraftKings is a really good story for that. They're making money now. And did it matter that people were shorting it? No, because now they're making money. They proved the people that were short wrong, and they're making money now. So kudos to them for doing well on the business side. Hopefully next time, if they have a bunch of people shorting it, they're not complaining about it, because honestly, like, focusing on short sellers is always a big red flag for management teams. They should focus on the business. Obviously, if they have to keep accessing money in capital markets, it does matter where your stock is. But that being said, like, they had at the time they had a path to profitability. They didn't need to access more money in the markets. So it didn't make a lot of sense to me why they were complaining about shorts. Today, I'm not an expert in this, but DraftKings needs to be profitable for a year on an EPS basis, I believe, in order to qualify. There are some ownership things. So I'm not a super expert in this, but there's certain voting requirements here. I don't know DraftKings corporate structure. They need to make sure that that's okay by the S&P 500. And they also have, like, there has to be, like, not one huge investor in DraftKings, which there isn't. So again, I'm absolutely not an expert in this, but I think if they continue to make money, I feel like that was the last straw. They're a big enough company. It's a $20 billion company, plenty big enough to be in the S&P 500. So I do think that, based on my understanding, it could be added in the next year or two or whatever.
Is that like a ticket for your stock just to go up? Like, if you were in the S&P 500, does that mean your stock automatically goes up because boomers are buying it every single day and wealth management's buying it every single day?
It absolutely is better to have that money coming into your stock every day than not, right? And we're seeing this huge gap of companies that do. Keep in mind, though, a lot of the benefit in the S&P 500 goes to the big ones. You know, DraftKings comes in, they're going to be one, like, 5,000th of the S&P every dollar that goes in. Right. So it gets magnified as it gets bigger market cap relative to the other ones.
Jason says, would love to hear Jason's take on technical analysis. Now, my understanding of technical analysis is people are drawing fucking triangles and they're saying what the market's going to do based on these triangles. That can't be winning, but maybe I'm wrong. What are your thoughts on technical analysis?
Yeah, I've gotten asked this a lot. So it's very clear that stocks are not a random walk. If you look at any kind of random walk simulation and you look at stocks, they don't look the same. On very short timeframes, they somewhat look similar. On longer timeframes, they don't. So we're on the same page. Stocks are not a random walk. I don't believe that. I don't think anyone believes that. There are absolutely patterns that repeat themselves over time. That being said, let's think about this really carefully. Who would be better at detecting these patterns on a short-term frame and a long-term frame? Would it be somebody on Twitter selling you a course on how to trade options or stocks? Or would it be a computer running a model and looking at tons of data in real time and making a lot of decisions? People that are set up to profit on either momentum trades or other type of technical analysis are not the people that are peddling it. The people that are peddling it are people that brokers people love it. You know, I would love to have a brokerage firm where everyone's trading technical analysis all day. They can trade. They probably like don't know what they're doing. Great. So I think you got to be really, really careful. Of course, there is value in understanding technical analysis, but you reading a book about it and then doing it in your account and drawing little triangles, that's not what's happening. Like, the people that are winning at this are sophisticated people running computer models with tons of data. This is not a human manual thing anymore. That's my view on it.
All right. Last question before we get Jason out of here. It comes from an old friend of the show, formerly of the online poker streets back in the day, A.E. Jones, Aaron Jones. Very important question. How many Thunder games does Jason go to a year? Jason lives in Oklahoma City. The firm is located in Oklahoma City. And he says, is Sam Presti, of course, GM of the Thunder, is Sam Presti an investor in Caption? I don't know if you can reveal that or not, Jason, but how many games are you going to? And is Presti an LP in your firm yet?
I can't reveal any investor information, but I don't know Sam Presti, so that should give you some angle on that. I have season tickets, so like row K right in the middle. It's nice being in a smaller market. You can get like really, and I got them like 4 years. I got them the first year of the tank, because when I first moved to Oklahoma City, there was like a long waiting list. Durant, you couldn't get season tickets. And then of course, when they did the rebuild, like they were readily available. So it's been a really nice process for me. Like, I went to a lot of games when they weren't very good. I probably go to 25 a year. I've been to all the playoff games. I love watching basketball. I'm just a huge sports fan. And so even when the Thunder weren't good, I love going and watching. And it's a really exciting time for them right now. What do you say? How are you feeling about my Thunder right now?
Oh, I actually think that they have a really good chance to go to the finals. I don't think it beat the Celtics, but I know it's 1-1 right now with Dallas. We're recording this on Friday, but yeah, I think they're mega live. My take on the NBA stuff is the delta between a playoff experience and a regular season experience is like 10x. Playoff is like literally 10x better, and the prices on the tickets are only like 2 to 3x more. So I don't go to many regular season games, but I try to go to as many playoff games as I can. You know, all the guys are out there playing hard. You know, everybody's going to suit up. I tried to go to a regular season game to see Sixers play Nuggets. Embiid didn't even play. My kids were like devastated, you know, but it was the playoffs. Of course, Embiid would play. So it, to me, like, if you have a chance to go to a playoff game over a regular season game, is just 25 regular season games sounds like hell to me. But yeah, good for you.
Yeah. So like, you want to see courtside one day. It's not like insane to do it. You know, like, I had friends come into town. We wanted to see Giannis play. Yeah. And of course, like, he freaking takes the game off. Like, they do a lot in Oklahoma City. But it's awesome. It's a really wonderful experience.
All right. Don't want to take up any more of Jason's time. Thank you so much for being here and sharing the knowledge on all this stuff. I find it super interesting. Tell the people where they can find you, assuming you actually want to be found.
Yeah, no, on Twitter, Strassa2 on Twitter, or X, whatever it's called now. I do get a lot of crazy, my spam DMs has gotten totally bananas, but I don't know, since Elon took over, it's just Wild West in my DMs. But I if you send me something, I'm happy to look at it in due time, and I like interacting with people on there. It's fun. I love the platform still.
Yeah, cool. My DMs are just dudes trying to hang out. It's not, there's no bots, there's no girls, it's just dudes trying to hang out in my DMs. All right. This was fun. For Jason, for Bruce or Luke, I am Adam. Good luck, everybody.